Project Green Star. As early as 1961, advisors to the late President Kennedy recommended that, with the threat of nuclear war hanging over the future, civilized nations could no longer risk overt confrontations that would lead to war, since even conventional war could escalate to Armageddon. If war was necessary, it would have to be invisible. It was either invisible warfare or peace, and everyone seemed to agree the economy would suffer from peace. Without war, it was believed, the economy would falter and depression would be the dividend of peace. Thus, the advisors to the president began to think about what might motivate the U.S. economy as well as war did. They came up with several possibilities, the most fantastic of which was to fake an invasion from outer space. Lewin says that a task force of 15 men met at Iron Mountain, New York, in August in 1963, and by September 30th, 1966, 7 days before LSD became illegal, they submitted their final report, known as the Report from Iron Mountain, on the possibility and desirability of peace. All the members of the task force wanted to keep their report secret from except one, Lewin says. This particular individual, Lewin says, contacted Leonard C. Lewin and offered to leak the report to him with a view having it published. Since none had signed a security oath, there was nothing except etiquette to keep the report from being published, and the person who contacted Lewin thought the report was too important to be kept secret. In 1967, Lewin told Paul Krasner that the report was a satire of his own authorship. He swore Paul to secrecy, and Paul never talked until now. Since when could you trust a journalist to keep a secret? Least of all, the news-hungry editor of The Realist. Ironically, Paul kept a secret. If Lewin was telling the truth, his satire was uncannily prophetic. Read it and make up your own mind. Leaking to Paul was the disinformation would be appropriate if Lewin wanted Paul to spread the news of a hoax, a common disinformation tactic of the cryptocracy. Many believe it was largely authored by Herman Kahn, whose fingerprints are all over their report. Kahn might have been momentarily enlightened by the large jolt of DMT Tim Leary gave him to bring him down from a bad acid trip shortly before the report from Iron Mountain was written. The Hudson Institute was started in 1961 when Herman Kahn, the owner, decided to help determine the entire future of the U.S. and, time permitting, much of the world beyond. The Institute received its $1.36 million income in 1968 from the Office of Civil Defense, the Office of Secretary of Defense, the Military Services, and, according to Life magazine, other government and non-U.S. government agencies. On the list of what it calls public members and fellows, the Institute published 10 of the 21 of its public members who were members of the Council on Foreign Relations, as well as 15 of the 34 fellows. Two of the fellows are very well known, Dr. Henry Kissinger and Dr. Milton Friedman. Author A. Ralph Efferson informs us that the corporations which created Iron Mountain included Standard Oil of New York, the Rockefeller interest, Manufacturers Hanover Trust, the Morgan interest, and the Shell Oil, the House of Orange, among others. The report, writes Epperson, dates back to at least 1961, when Robert McNamara, McGeorge Bundy, and Dean Rusk, all members of the CFR, noticed that no serious study had been made without planning for a long-term peace. Not only were they concerned about the lasting effects of long-term peace, they also wished to examine the functions, both visible and invisible, of war. Apparently, the author, Gary Allen, made an attempt to locate the authors of the report from Iron Mountain. He concluded that it had been written by the Hudson Institute. He wrote, "There is considerable evidence that the report in this work of the Hudson Institute and Herman Kahn, there is an Iron Mountain just a stone's throw, literally, from the Hudson Institute near Croton on Hudson, New York." The reader is invited to compare Kahn's style in, say, Thinking the Unthinkable with the report from Iron Mountain. Loon was the husband of leftist activist and journalist Eve Merriman. Krasner says he had no reason not to trust Lewin's confession. If Lewin was not to try to get the cry out literally hoaxed circulated, which would have helped circulation of the likewise dull book, he might have been taking the blame for Kahn, laying down his reputation as the cover story. On the other hand, Krasner says, it could have been a satire, one that was true. There really could have been a group such as Iron Mountain 15 talking about things which were reported, but the book itself might have been put on Hudson Institute's style and content. Another satire that came true, that life does limitate art. Colonel Fletcher Prouty was also told by Lewin in the late 1980s that the book was a satire, but the people at the Hudson Institute, the Pentagon, and the government contractors were talking like this in-house in days, so it really hasn't been exaggerated at all. Prouty told me. I've always believed it was leaked information. And in his book, JFK, the CIA, Vietnam, and the Plot to Assassinate JFK, Prouty wrote, quote, during the Kennedy years, people within the government and their close associates in academia and industry discussed frequently and quite seriously many of the major questions phrased by Leonard Lewin in a report from Iron Mountain. I had been assigned to the office of the Secretary of Defense before the Kennedy election, and was there when he and McNamara team Whiz Kids arrived. Never before had so many brilliant young civilians with so many PhDs worked in that office. It was out of the mouths of this group that I heard so frequently, and precisely the ideas that Lewin recounts in his novel. For example, in National Security Memorandum 68, George Kennan wrote, quote, we have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. In this situation, we cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which all permit us to maintain this position of disparity. To do so, we will have to disperse and dispense with all sentimentality and daydreaming, and our attention we will have to be concentrated everywhere on our immediate national objectives. We should cease to talk about vague and unreal objectives such as human rights, the raising of a living standards, and democratization. The day is not far off when we are going to have to deal in straight power concepts. The less we are then hampered by idealistic slogans, the better. The straight power concepts are what the report from Iron Mountain is made of. Published in 1967, the report drew immediate attention for its then bizarre suggestions. In a review of the report in the Washington Post section, John Kenneth Galbraith, writing under the name Herschel Landrus, acknowledged that it might be as a shock to American people to know that war is considered by these experts to be a highly desirable component of modern society. They believe this to be true because, number one, war provides the only dependable system for stabilizing and controlling national economics. Number two, war is the basis for giving the necessary authority to government to ensure political stability. Number three, war is indispensable sociologically for the purpose of controlling, quote, dangerous real dissidents and destructive with antisocial tendencies. Number four, war serves an indispensable Malthusian function of reducing the population at regular intervals. Number five, war is the primary motivational force for scientific and technological progress. The report was a substantial example of the type of secret expert planning which was to become essential in formulating policies in Washington, rather than listening to the expressed desires and aspirations of the American electorate. The ideological attitudes and intellectual tone of these experts were as follows. Number one, the Iron Mountain experts believed the value of war was an institution should be determined without reference to ethics, morality, or any other measurements. Number two, they said major industrial advances could never have taken a place if it had not been for war. Number three, they said defense spending was not wasteful since it stimulates the economy. Number four, They said the threat of war was necessary to give political leaders an essential control over the people, and if no threat exists, political leaders should set about creating one. Number five, they said political control could be assured by permanently institutionalizing a large segment of poor who are dependent upon the politicians and would therefore vote for them and keep them in power. The continuance of the war system must be assured, if for no other reason, among others, than to preserve whatever quality and degree of poverty society requires as incentive to support the regime in power, as well as to maintain the stability of its internal organization of power. Number six, they said the army was needed as a pool for the misfits. Number seven, they looked upon the army as a state-supported haven for the unemployable. Number eight, these experts believe that the latest weapons for mass destruction constituted an important factor in population control. They lamented that conventional weapons did not kill enough to reduce the consuming population to a level consistent with survival of the species. Number nine, they regretted that modern medicine cured so many pestilences and thereby interfered with the natural selection process through survival of the fittest, suggesting that the day must come when human reproduction would be artificial insemination so as to permit direct eugenic management. Number 10. They gave detailed consideration to various peacetime substitutes for the essential functions which they attributed to war, but came to the conclusion that war was superior to anything they could suggest as a practical substitute at that time. After a lengthy discussion of ways to control society and keep it within numerical and economic bounds without war, the report from Iron Mountain boiled it all down to a summary entitled, Substitutes for the Functions of War Models. The following substitute institutions, among others, have been proposed for consideration as replacements for the non-military functions of war. That they may not have been originally set forth for the purpose does not preclude or invalidate their possible application here. Number one, economic. A. A comprehensive social welfare program directed toward maximum improvement of general conditions of human life. B. A giant open-ended research program aimed at unreachable targets. C. A permanent ritualized ultra-elaborate disarmament inspection system and variants of such a system. Number two, political. A. An omnipresent, virtually omnipotent international police force. B. An established and recognized extraterrestrial menace. C. Massive global environmental pollution. D. Fictitious alternative enemies. Number three, sociological control function. A. Programs generally derived from the Peace Corps model. B. A modern, sophisticated form of slavery, motivational function. Intensified environmental pollution. New religions or other mythologies. C. Socially orientated blood games. D. Combination forms. Number four, ecological. A comprehensive program of applied eugenics. Number five, cultural, no replacement institution offered. Scientific, secondary requirements of the space research, social welfare, and or eugenics programs. In the evaluation that followed, it was decided that the space research substitute appears to meet both major criteria and should be examined in greater detail, especially in respect to its probable effects on the other war functions. Development of an acceptable threat from outer space, presumably in conjunction with a space research surrogate for economic model control, appears unpromising in terms of credibility, the experts decided. Without the foresight of 30 years, the experts concluded, the environmental pollution model does not seem sufficiently responsive to immediate social control, except through an arbitrary acceleration of current pollution trends. The Iron Mountain experts proposed the establishment. Under executive order of the President of a permanent war peace research agency, empowered and mandated to execute the programs described in 2 and 3 below. This agency, A, will be provided with non-accountable funds sufficient to implement its responsibilities and decisions at its own discretion, and B, will have authority to preempt and utilize without restriction any all facilities of the executive branch of the government in pursuit of objectives. Emphasis added, it will be organizing along the lines of National Security Council, except that none of its governing executive or operating personnel will hold either public office or government responsibility. Number two, the first of the War Peace Research Agency's two principal responsibilities will be to determine all that can be known, including what can be reasonably be inferred in terms of relevant statistical probabilities that may bear on an eventual transition to a general condition of peace. Number three, the War Peace Research Agency's other principal responsibilities will be war research. Its fundamental objectives will be to ensure the continuing viability of the war system, to fulfill its essential non-military functions for as long as the war system is judged necessary to or desirable for the survival of society. In the discussion preceding above, we find the following relevant commentary. Credibility, in fact, lies at the heart of the problem of developing a political substitute for war. This is where the space race proposals, in many ways so well suited as economic substitutes for war, fall short. The most ambitious and unrealistic space project cannot of itself guarantee and generate a believable external menace. It has to be hotly argued that such a menace would offer the last best hope of peace. By uniting mankind against the danger of destruction by creatures from other planets or from outer space. Experiments have been proposed to test the credibility of an out-of-world invasion threat. It is possible that a few of the more difficult-to-explain flying saucer incidents of recent years were in fact early experiments of this kind. 13 years after the report from Iron Mountain, and 1 year after Operation Mind Control was first published, the astrophysicist, computer scientist, and ufologist Dr. Jacques Vallée published Messengers of Deception. To my knowledge, this was the first book to mention mind control in connection with UFOs, especially the abductee phenomenon. The manipulators, I have given this name to the agents who cause the UFO contacts and other engineer their crafts, everything now centers on their role, their identity, their designs. Who could they be? Alien beings from the end of the galaxy, psychic entities from other side, automa controlled by some non-human consciousness, holographic nightmares, but perhaps we are looking far away from something which is right under our nose. Could they simply be human? Could they be masters of deception so skillful that they counterfeit an invasion from space? It is not difficult to see that the same themes are running through the whole puzzle. Many contactees, for example, mention Atlantis. Our self-styled space brothers need to such a prehistoric pedigree. Is it reasonable to expect them to come from such a faraway star? The real answer is both mundane and more frightening. Beyond the attention of academic science, below the dignity of official history, there are groups, cults, and sects that serve as leading indicators of mass movements. The myth of contact is such a leading indicator. Vallée took all his papers one day and drove to the house of Majority Murphy, who had advised him of his UFO research before. Major Murphy and Vallée quickly agreed that the popular idea of flying saucers from outer space left much to be explained. Major Murphy, Vallée said, reported that the U.S. had evidence in 1943 that several countries had been working on circular aircraft, which they hoped developed in secret weapons. The Nazis, he said, were doing advanced research on controlled electrical discharges and controlled lightning, and had tried to combine these things together. Then, when the Allies invaded Germany, a lot of that hardware fell into the U.S. and Russian hands. Then people started seeing the modern UFOs in Sweden in 1946, Vallée reports. General James Doolittle was sent to Sweden by the United States in 1946, apparently under cover of the Shell Corporation. In fact, he was to investigate the ghost rockets with the Swedish authorities, whatever came of that. His conclusions have never been revealed, with a sigh that seemed to say, if only the Pentagon could talk. This took place a year before Kenneth Arnold named his disc that he saw over his Mount Rainier, flying saucers. One area where you must realize a lot of research had already been done in Gates Frequency in 1946, Vallee quotes Major Murphy saying, concern mind control and the effects of electromagnetic radiation on the human body. Vallee asked the Major what that had to do with rockets, UFOs, or secret weapons. Quote, on the surface, if you just take a look at a few isolated cases, like scientists arguing about UFOs, well, I agree it doesn't mean anything, Vallee quotes Murphy saying. But suppose somebody had obtained a device by the end of the war which perhaps wasn't a very effective weapon. Perhaps it couldn't fly very effectively, couldn't carry guns or bombs, but had other properties. For instance, it could emit radiation that caused paralysis and hallucinations as it flew over an area. So that they witnessed exposed to it would think they saw the phantasms of their own imagination. Did somebody test that kind of device in Sweden in 1946 and the States in 1947 and find it had to be ineffective as a flying machine but very useful as a means of propaganda? Has such a group already understood what UFOs were and are watching, or are they confusing the issue by simulating UFO waves? Or is the entire phenomena under their control? Vallee said it was hard for him to believe that techniques could be applied on the kind of scale as was being reported, even in 1979. Vallee quotes the Major saying, don't you read the newspapers? Don't you follow publications on mind control? The military has been using this kind of technique for years. Vallee describes Major Murphy pulling out a file of a series of New York Times clippings, beginning in 1977, which describes part of the U.S. project which spanned 35 years and involved hypnosis, narcoanalysis, electronic brain stimulation, and the behavioral effects of every physical vibration known to science, from ultrasound to microwaves. Vallee writes, quote, he showed me a book entitled Operation Mind Control, in which W.H. Boehrert describes his meeting with a young man who had just returned from a tour of duty with the Air Force. He suffered from amnesia. Like many UFO contactees, he remembered vaguely that he had a good name and a good time, but he couldn't describe in detail where he had been. After many therapy sessions, he began to recall part of his activities. He had served, it seemed, on a military committee in Vietnam. He had been trained for total recall. Then his entire memory of the assignments was erased like some magnetic cassette. See Chapter 2, Only Mine for My Country. Giving me time to absorb this information, Major Murphy gestured toward the notes I had compiled on the UFO contactees and their sex. You have assembled case histories on other interesting groups. Don't misunderstand me, he said. I'm not suggesting that secret agents are going around the world giving these thousands of people individual suggestions to see UFOs, as we have found out when we begin developing the science of propaganda during that last war. You don't need to do all that. A few well-placed stories, well-planned program publicized in sensational incidents will do marvels. The contactees are being manipulated, and I think we should not look at outer space for the manipulators. Vallee asked the Major where he would look, then for the answer to the riddle of the UFOs. Right here on Earth, said the Major, with the satisfied air of mathematics professor who has succeeded in proving a specially vexing theorem. The best place to start looking for them is among some of the occult groups. Such organizations are in the ideal place for a clever individual to exercise his influence, because they are ignored by the intellectuals, by those who call themselves scientific investigators. They are afraid of looking silly if they join the Order of the Melezek. We will then, Dean say, when he finds out. The same year, Messengers of Deception was published. Carl Jung's niece, Lou Zistag, wrote a book about her friend, one of the first contactees, George Adamski. In it, Zistag mentions Operation Mind Control, telling how this report of the cryptocracy's operations and mind control helped her understand things about Adamski, which had remained unexplainable. Adamski's testimony in his book Flying Saucers Have Landed, co-authored by Desmond Loseley, reported that on November 20th, 1952, the author encountered Venusian wearing one-piece bodysuits with long blonde hair somewhere near a desert in California. Venusian told Adamski that he was gravely concerned about recent atomic bomb tests. This message would become the litany of other contactees. Flying Saucer Clubs sprang up. Lecturers earned their living speaking on an international circuit of UFO conventions. The government denied the existence of UFOs, and there, apparently, was no physical evidence from them. When there was evidence, UFO lore has it, men in black would come and seize it, warning witnesses to keep their mouths shut. Often described as tall Oriental men wearing black sunglasses and driving detailed black Cadillacs, the men in black were masters of intimidation. Mysterious phone calls and black helicopters often preceded their visits. Lou Zinstag asked Adamski about the man in black who had just started to make headlines in Europe. Quote, "I was astonished to hear him acknowledge their existence without hesitation, adding they are not always in black, and they certainly belong to our own kind. They are well-trained and committed to do their utmost in order to scare people away from getting interested in a new kind of cosmic knowledge, which is rightfully ours." He also asserted that, of necessity, they have to be faceless men. You will never catch one. Asked if they belonged to CIA, he hesitated a moment and then said, "Not necessarily. But I also remember him telling me that some of them are very well versed in telepathy, hypnotism, trance, and other forces which can be subtly applied without the immediate detection. And they got their schooling from CIA." In Gray Barker's book on Adamski, published after George's death, an undated article was published entitled, "My Fight with the Silence Group." Quote, "Shortly after the publication of Flying Saucers Have Landed, I was visited by three men, two of which I had met previously, but the third was a stranger. It was he who took the role of authority and directly threatened me, demanding certain papers I had, for one thing. Some of these I gave him. I was promised their return, but this promise was never kept, since I did not exactly understand to what he had reference. I did not give him some of my many more important papers. There is no need denying that I was frightened. Before they left, I was told to stop talking or they would come after me, lock me up, and throw away the key." Evidence in Jerome Clark's The UFO Encyclopedia, Volume 2, suggests that Barker may himself have been a disinformation asset for the cryptocracy. Barker was undeniably responsible, along with James Moseley, for one of the most notorious hoaxes of the 1950s. A December 1957 letter written to the State Department stationery by one R.E. Strafe and addressed to contactee George Adamski, Strafe claimed that the department knew of the truth of Adamski's reported meetings with Space Brothers and was quietly supporting his efforts. It was concluded that the letter had been written on Barker's typewriter, but Moseley refused to publish his manuscript on the subject until after Adamski's death. Then Moseley confirmed the long-standing rumors about the document's true provenance. An inveterate UFO convention attendee, Moseley maintains his position of skeptic in the crowd of true believers. He has been accused of being an intelligence asset over the years by UFO researchers. At a 1983 UFO convention, he said Candy Jones' manager told him that her story was just a hoax. "That's hard to believe in light of others whose programming is almost identical to Candy's, and in the face of leaked CIA interrogation transcripts of Candy, who apparently did have handlers both inside and outside the agency." UFO lore is filled with conflicting information and deception. In fact, it's doubtfully hard to believe UFOs are real, first because of public incredulity, peer pressure not to believe, and second, because for every plausible explanation of their reality, there's an equally plausible explanation of their unreality. It certainly appears that somebody is waging an artful psychological warfare campaign. The campaigners would have it that if you want to believe in UFOs, you can find enough evidence to present a logical argument for their existence. And if you don't want to believe in UFOs, you can also find enough evidence to present a logical argument against their existence. This would be an appropriate intelligent effort if indeed this planet were being invaded by an alien race far in advance of our own. Also possible is the scheme of a real UFO invasion being manipulated as a shield for high technology research projects. Either way, ufology is a classic study in plausible deniability. It is a history of rumors documented by almost 50 years of uncoordinated effort by independent researchers. And, on the other hand, it may be an organized escape valve to mass hysteria or an ordered presentation of mass hallucination created by almost 50 years of mind control, or both. It is highly likely that at least some of the abduction scenarios are being programmed by mind control technology and used as screens or scrambles to cover something else. But Zietstag said Adamski knew exactly where his opposition came from. Quote, "He survived their plots and he refused their money offers, but it looks as if he had not been prepared to counter more subtle or more sophisticated methods, which in the end were effective in discrediting our old friend. There is some reason to suspect that, for a certain time at least, Adamski was fed false information by some cunning impersonators of spacemen who could have been members of CIA agents. I know how outrageous this idea sounds to saucer enthusiasts who are still convinced of the space visitor's infallibility and trustworthiness," Zietstag said, "but I am not so sure any longer. Now, in 1979, we may assume that Adamski fell for some of their tricks as early as in the 60s. He was so right when he wrote that the destruction of his image was their major target, but he failed to perceive the moment when it came out. He seemed to be overrated not only his faculty for perception, but also his strength to stay clear of such weird manipulations." In one of our private talks, Adamski had admitted to possessing remarkable psychic gifts, such as putting himself and other people into trance, and that he was able to hypnotize himself, but he never made any use of it, and, as he fiercely added, nobody would ever be able to put him into a trance or hypnosis without his own wish or consent. November 1963. He wrote, "I was talking to a man well-versed in mesmerism and hypnosis. He is visiting there from the Middle East, and he has used both these in U.S. government work. I wanted to know if I was right in my knowledge of it, and this was what he told me. There are people who will not lend themselves to either hypnotism or mesmerism by direct suggestion. He said that I was the one who would not, for I make thorough analysis before acting. I often wondered if this could be a clever move of a CIA agent, with a purpose, wanting to make him careless or to put him at ease. I don't think that Adamski knew at the time there was such a thing as a hypnosis at a distance. But there was one thing he knew, that with the years that shadowing of his person was bound to grow, and they were closely closing in on him, as he said. He knew perfectly well with his first book already he had stuck his head out once and for all times. And until they make me and get me, I'm making the best use I can of the freedom of the press in this country and also the freedom of speech." When in April 1965 he set out to lecture one more and around Washington, D.C., he must have felt the fear of God in his bones. He knew that not only did CIA was after him, he knew that he had more formidable adversaries. Going through my files, I found the copy of my letter to Hank Heffner, written in May 1965. I remember Adamski telling me more than once that he would never enter a hospital in the U.S. if he could help himself, because you never know what kind of injection they would make it or what kind of drug they would put you in your food. And another time he said bluntly, "I would rather die in a street than enter a hospital." He also told me that, as an exception, he would use a shortened version of his name, -KI, being the Polish ending for any male name, when he felt a kind of insecurity while entering a hotel. This, he said, was no falsification of his name,
and that, in fact, he could have discarded the last syllable long ago. Nobody would have objected to that, and he had always wanted to keep the name that he got from his father. With this letter, Hank received a copy of the UPI report, which I had received from an unknown friend, published in an unknown newspaper. Flying saucer expert is dead. Washington, UPI, April 30th, 1965. A man who claimed to have visited other planets is dead. For a period after his death, that was like the flying saucer he studied, were identified. George Adamski, 74-year-old resident of Vista, California, who was only last month told Washington newsmen he had made several interplanetary trips aboard a craft from outer space, died last Friday night in Washington Sanitarium at nearby Tacoma Park, Maryland. Dr. Belden Reap, deputy medical examiner from Montgomery County, Maryland, confirmed his death this morning, shortly after Adamski was buried in a private service at Arlington National Cemetery. He said that Adamski apparently died of a heart attack. The hospital indicated the reason his death was not reported sooner was the original records listed him as Adams rather than Adamski. Authorities finally located Adamski's daughter, Mrs. Alice Wells, Vista. About Lou Zisting's quote, in which the man well-versed in a mesmerism hypnosis had told Adamski that there are people who will not lend themselves to either hypnotism nor mesmerism by direct suggestion, and, he said, I was one who could not be suggestible, for I make thorough analysis before acting. It is a well-known trick of hypnotists to agree with those who say they can't be hypnotized. It establishes a rapport with the skeptic to agree that they can't be hypnotized. Then the hypnotist says something like, well, then just close your eyes for a few minutes so I can show you how guided imagery works. It is exactly as Adamski reported it. The subconscious robot mind responds usually to what may be called the language of the unconscious. If the influencer confuses the analytical mind, or it occupies it with the process of considering a paradox or profound problem, and while it searches its various filing compartments, which those skilled in the art of subconscious influencing can tell by the pattern of the subject's eye movements and other involuntary responses, various linguistic approaches might allow access to setting up an embedded command, which can be magically effective in so much as the command appears to be congruent with the subject's desires. These techniques are no secret. They are spelled out in detail in the works of Milton Erickson and others. A complete knowledge of NLP or the various schools of Ericksonian hypnosis serve as the only self-defense I know of against such invasive hypnotic techniques. As I pointed out in 1978, I will again in this expanded edition. Hypnosis is merely another technology which can benefit or harm. The trick of the unethical influencer is to manipulate the context so that the subconscious mind thinks that the performing on it, the embedded command, it will help the individual achieve his outcome, when in fact he is actually giving the influencer his outcome without knowing it. When an embedded command is followed by a change of subject, magicians call this misdirection, amnesia sets in, and the subject, or the case target, forgets the command even after it's triggered. It is possible that George Adamski was a victim of MKUltra program in more ways than one. Whether or not he had been a UFO or photographed one, his alleged trip to Saturn and other adventures might serve to debunk his credibility, might have been carefully cultivated experiments in his unconscious mind. If this were the case, who can tell what produced the fantastic and apparently unscientific descriptions of the solar system and such claims that birds have migrated from one planet to another through space? 10 years after Vallee and Zitzdag's books came, The Controllers, Mind Control and Mass, and Project MKUltra, Modern Myth, Mass Manipulation, and the New Hypothesis of Alien Abductions by Martin Cannon. A 64-page booklet originally published in installments in the MUFON Journal, the house organ of alleged CIA co-opted UFO organization. Cannon posted, "The abductees have been abducted, yet they are also spewing fantasy, or more precisely, they have been given a set of lies to repeat and believe. If my hypothesis proves true, then we must accept this following, the kidnapping is real. The fear is real, the pain is real, the instructions are real,
But little gray men from Zeta Reticuli are not real. They are constructs. Halloween masks meant to disguise the real faces of the controllers. The abductors may not be visitors from beyond, rather, they may be a symptom of their carcinoma, which blackens our body politic. Substantial evidence exists linking members of this country's intelligence community, including CIA, DIA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, and the Office of Naval Intelligence, with the esoteric technology of mind control. For decades, psychiatrists working within the scenes on college campuses and CIA-sponsored institutes, and mostly heinously in prisons, have experimented with the erasure of memory, hypnotic resistance to torture, truth serum, post-hypnotic suggestion, rapid induction of hypnosis, electronic stimulation of the brain, non-ionizing radiation, microwave induction of intercerebral voices, and a host of even more disturbing technologies. Cannon agrees with CIA veteran Miles Copeland, who once admitted to Robert Iringer of Rolling Stone. Quote, "The Congressional Subcommittee, which went into this sort of thing, got only the barest glimpse," end quote. Cannon argues that much of the testimony before Congress on CIA's brainwashing efforts was perjury. He says the clandestine research into thought manipulation was not stopped but went operational, and he asserts any claims of the contrary are cover stories. He presented evidence, as we have, that a number of government agencies, CIA, NSA, Atomic Energy Commission, as well as a variety of agencies of the Department of Defense, are all involved in research and operations to this day, and that the UFO abduction phenomena, at least in part, is quite likely a continuation of the clandestine mind control operations. Perhaps the most interesting piece of information and evidence surrounding the abduction phenomena are the intercerebral implants, allegedly visible in the X-rays and MRI scans of many abductees. Indeed, abductees often describe operations in which needles are inserted into the brain. More frequently still, they report implantation of foreign objects through the sinus cavities. Many abduction specialists assume that these intracranial incursions might be the handiwork of scientists from the stars. Unfortunately, these researchers have failed to familiarize themselves with certain little heralded advances in terrestrial technology. The abductee's implants strongly suggest a technological lineage which can be traced to a device known as a stim receiver, invented in the late 50s and early 60s by a neuroscientist named Jose Delgado. Addressing the large number of implants, reports by abductees, Cannon writes, "If we are to take seriously abductee accounts of brain implants, we must consider the possibility that the implanters, properly perceived, don't much look like grays pictured on Whitley Strieber's dust jackets. Instead, the visitors may resemble Dr. Joseph Meyer and his brethren." Cannon says, "Meyer is perhaps the most disturbing wanderer in the minefield of National Security Agency, the most formidable and secretive component of America's national security complex. Meyer has proposed implanting roughly half of all Americans arrested, not necessarily convicted of any crime. The number of subscribers, his euphemism, would run into the lens of millions. Subscribers could be monitored continually by computer wherever they went. Meyer, who has carefully worked out the economies of mass manipulation and implementation into the system, asserts that taxpayer liability should be reduced by forcing subscribers to rent the implant from the state. Implants are cheaper and more efficient than police, Meyer suggests, since the call to crime is relentless from the poor urban dweller, who this spoke, scientists admits, in an unsurprisingly candid aside, is fundamentally unnecessary to a post-industrial economy. Urban dweller may be another of Meyer's euphemisms. He uses New York's Harlem as his model community and working out the detail of his mind-managed system." Meyer, Cannon continues, "Could be one of the top men behind the abduction brain implants, the scoop market, and other scars on abductees' bodies. We would also have an explanation for the reports of individuals suffering personality change after contact with the UFO phenomena. By all indications,
The Iron Mountain Report was implementing the Secret War Peace Research Agency, whatever it may be named. Environmental pollution has accelerated new invisible forms of killing. Viral infections are appearing with increasing frequency. Evidence of experiments with bizarre religious cults, the Unification Church, the Branch Davidians, the People's Temples, and others testify to a secret hand on the pulpit. And now comes the clincher. Victims of government mind control remembering enough to begin to testify about their alien programming. The Lincoln SNL conspiracy witness, Paul Bonacci, testified to a number of code names for significant programs. Some names matched those given by other victims who did not know Bonacci. There was Wizard of Oz and Alice in Wonderland, one project codenamed Alien. Bonacci said, quote, "The Alien program, which they used, Alien, was mainly under Star Wars. This would fit with Aquino's reported penchant to dress up like Darth Vader, and it would be consistent with his frustrated literary urge to extend the Star Wars trilogy." Bonacci positively identified Aquino as one of the programmers. Satanic activities, Bonacci said, were also a frequent part of the Monarch programming. The Satanic and Alien programs took place almost always on military grounds. "I said all the alien stuff happened in Colorado, up in the mountains, and also I think they did it mostly where there was hardly any chance there would be a lot of people around." Bonacci describes some of the alien programming as taking place in caves underground. "They took you in the caves, which they had to set up. Some of them had alien spaceships so you could walk into it. Even now, they keep showing the movies that have alien spaceships with caverns in them. Even you got away from them and went around these caverns, you think, well, man, this is just like the movies." Julian McKinney, director of the Electronic Surveillance Project of the Association of National Security Alumni, reports that she was interviewed 125 victims of government mind control. One of them had apparently been part of the alien programming. The woman, now an adult in her 40s, told McKinney of being used in the alien project as a young child because she was small and just the right size for wearing the costume of a gray, the big-headed alien with big eyes and a skinny neck with many UFO abductees sketching under hypnosis. The woman was cult-controlled. She claimed to have played a role in the perpetuation of the UFO abduction myth, i.e., as a member of the DOD-affiliated satanic cult. As a little girl, when she was made to wear an ET costume, when describing the costume, this woman said that the head and neck were manipulated by means of electronic gadgetry built into the costume. The Babylon 5 praying mantis costumes, which also had an elongated neck and eyes, were situated far above the wearer's head. It is also operated by means of electronic gadgetry built into the costume. The ET costume worn by this woman antedated Babylon's 5 special effects costuming by approximately 10 to 15 years. "Have you noticed how the special effects technologies in science fiction films have evolved at approximately the same rate as the special effects being employed in so-called UFO abductions and sightings? The flying saucers reportedly seen by the public during the 1950s were about as sophisticated as those which were portrayed in science fiction films during that same period. By today's standards, both were quite primitive. The special effects in today's science fiction films have become quite sophisticated. Similarly, persons who now claim to have been abducted or have seen UFOs are describing scenes and events which parallels those news being seen in science fiction films in the form of special effects. Having been given no reason to believe otherwise, I have personally concluded that the so-called UFO abductions and the events surrounding those abductions and sightings are a black intelligence operation involving government-sponsored kidnappings, experimental drugs, surgical experimentation, sophisticated electronics, and directed energy technologies, implantable microcircuited devices, experimental aircraft, Hollywood-style special effects, and the exploitation of so-called abductees as sources of ova, sperm, and aborted fetuses for use in government-sponsored genetic experiments."
These reported activities do not require the involvement or intellectual input of extraterrestrials. In fact, given the alleged superior capabilities of ETs, these UFO operations come across as being really quite bungled, redundant, and primitive. Their failure to outpace Hollywood's development of special effects technologies or DoD's weapons technologies also points to totally human involvement. In summation, McKinney continued, I see these UFO activities as being nothing more than a massive covert intelligence fraud being perpetrated upon a global public, a lucrative large-scale mind control operation qualifying as an attempt at creating the cult to end all cults, the cult from outer space. McKinney says another source told her that there was a project headed by Michael Aquino that involves the programming of so-called UFO abductees. The source told her that the project is codenamed Green Star and is a mind control operation involving an overlapping of satanic cults, the U.S. military, and the UFO community. McKinney said, Michael Aquino is alleged under these circumstances to have his hand in two major types of DoD-sponsored mind control operations, satanic cults, and now abductions. Other researchers say there could be a long-term narco-hypnotic abduction program using costuming and movie sets as covers for implanting terrifying screen-or-scramble memories of phony abductions by big-headed short gray aliens, the idiovulgata of ufology's abductee memories. Bonacci described being given drugs on his Monarch programming. One drug they used, he said, was sodium pentothal. They'd lower your conscious level just enough that you're aware of what's going on, but your mental thinking is blocked. Denise Meyer told us that the small children in Nebraska, aged 4 and 5, were beginning to report alien encounters to the therapists. The kids are describing little green men that fit the description of the Greys. They're also describing green UFOs. It appears these are screen memories used to block the memories of something else. While guesstimates project members of victims of the cryptocracy mind control to be in the tens of thousands, a 1993 Roper poll had been interpreted to indicate that 6 out of 10 million North Americans have experienced alien abduction. Somebody must be working overtime. If you still have serious doubts that mind control could be part of the Project Alien or some named activity, take a look at this letter from Walter B. Smith, the 20-year director of CIA. Declassified on 20 April 1977, the letter is thought to have been written in 1952. CIA Memorandum 2, Director, Psychological Strategy Board, Subject, Flying Saucers. Number 1, I am today transmitting to the National Security Council a proposed TABA, in which it is concluded that the problems connected with unidentified flying objects appear to have implications for psychological warfare as well as for intelligence and operations. Number 2. The background for this view is presented in some detail in Tab B. Number 3. I suggest that we discuss at an early bird meeting the possible offensive or defensive utilization of these phenomena for psychological warfare purposes. Enclosure, Walter B. Smith, Director. Of course, Tab A and Tab B could not be found. So much for the value of the Freedom of Information Act. Many of the survivors of the so-called Project Monarch are remembering alien scenarios, while ordinary folks are those reporting their abductions. The thing they both have in common is the amnesia they have experienced for so many years after the event. Without question, most of the effects described by the abductee can be duplicated by the cryptocracy and mind control handlers. In fact, one prominent deprogrammer suggests that after working out the appropriate legal documents to protect him from liability, he would ask for abduction volunteers. His idea was to bring the volunteers before an audience at one of the lectures and perform the programming with high-voltage shocks, which create the same screen memories and missing time that the abductees are reporting. The most recent reports grow more disturbing and more difficult to explain, entirely by what we know of the state of the mind control arts. A letter came from a Colorado woman who previously reported to me an encounter she had with what appeared to be an alien, along with a human male who appeared to be government techie.
She is in contact with other abductees, and just before, we went to present us some email about two other friends who had experienced some similar events. I have some new testimony which may be of interest to you. This concerns the abduction of two other women. I have requested permission of these two women to share their experiences and hope that it will generate interest and help demonstrate a connection between your studies and ours. This type of encounter is very common in abduction scenarios. In the words of one, a few months ago, one of my experiences involved a pelvic exam and my asking telepathically, why, and being told by a sarcastic male voice, because you like it so much. I then saw two male human beings. I was told one was CIA and one was FBI, and they were going to make sure I didn't try and leave the country. This type of experiment is not a classic abduction experience, but is not uncommon to those who have had the same begins to study questions and explore this type of phenomena. Many people do not try and find out what is happening to them, but simply follow as sheeple. The pelvic exam is common, but the sarcastic male voice is not. There is no gender associated with telepathic communications in typical abductions, and there is no emotion, sarcastic or otherwise. End of part 1.